I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats now say the vote on health reform will be Sunday. And Democrats Dennis Kucinich of Ohio and Dale Kildee of Michigan are now on board, as are dozens of Catholic nuns. Republicans are focusing on process, that tortured deem provision that allows Congress to pass a version of the bill, then change the bill and vote on the changed version. Let's check in. Rick Klein is a senior political correspondent for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. Rick, what's going on today?
Well, we've got numbers, and we're about to get legislation this afternoon as well. The Congressional Budget Office has come along with their long-awaited analysis of the Senate bill plus the fixes that they've been negotiating, and the cost is $940 billion over 10 years, and there's an estimate that it would actually cut the deficit because of new revenues by about $130 billion. Over 10 years. So those are critical numbers. The Democrats needed to show they were cutting the deficit. They also have wanted, under President Obama's guidelines, to keep the overall cost under $1 trillion. I think this is something that's likely to get some of the on-the-fence members off the fence.
And how important is the endorsement of leaders of Catholic nuns?
I think that's a big development. Obviously, the church has been split, but having nuns come forward and say, look, this is the true pro-life position, is to support this, is important in terms of explaining the potential for support on this bill for pro-life Democrats. There's a group of 10 to 12 of them who've been following the lead of Congressman Bart Stupak, a Democrat from Michigan, in saying that they were not comfortable with the language in the House legislation. In the Senate legislation. They wanted the House language instead. So this is important cover for them.
And the nuns are saying that they think health care is more a matter of social justice. Others, like Dale Kildee of Michigan, have been looking at the language, and they say actually they don't think that the language in the bills overrides the Hyde Amendment, which, of course, bans any federal funding of abortions. But Republicans are still focusing on process, and that was evident in the president's interview with Fox News last night. He spoke with Bret Baier. Let's listen to one exchange. Baier had been asking President Obama about the process that we spoke of, the deem process, but he'd also been asking him in general about health care. And here the president is responding to an interruption, saying that things aren't going to change for most people.
The only thing that is going to change for them is that they're going to have more security under their insurance, and they're going to have a better situation when it comes to if they lose their job, heaven forbid, or somebody gets sick with a pre-existing condition, they'll have more security.
So how
but
can
so,
you,
so this, so the notion,
you guarantee so that they're not going to they're going to be able to keep their doctor?
Brad, you got to let me finish my answers.
But, sir, I know you don't like the filibuster.
I'm trying to answer your questions, and you keep on interrupting.
Rick, couple questions. Has there been fallout from this, from the number of interruptions?
You know, I don't think people were surprised by the tone of the interview given the venue, and I don't think the White House should have been surprised either. But I got to say, I'm not sure that this would have reached the intended audience in the right way. The president, I think, seemed defensive at times, and he was trying to reach clearly voters in a lot of these swing districts where the members of Congress are on the fence. You may have higher penetration of Fox News viewers there. It's an interesting choice of venue, certainly. I don't know that it was the best format, though, for the president.
And could the president perhaps have done better in answering the questions about process? Others have said both parties have used this deem provision at other times.
The president himself has said that process matters here. He ran on process. Everyone remembers the C-SPAN pledge about health care negotiations. So to say that it's really not relevant, I don't think is consistent with what he has said in the past. And clearly, it's penetrated with the American people. People have been focused in on this. They'll continue to be so. But I think he's also right in saying that ultimately this is about the policy. This is going to be judged on what it does for the American people a lot more than the manner in which it was passed.
Well, but what about that? Because Fred Barnes in the Wall Street Journal has a different view. He says enacting health care is just the beginning. It's going to continue to preoccupy the president. And the controversy surrounding its passage and the process is going to have an impact. Others, the Nation, for instance, is saying nobody remembers process. They only remember, for instance, civil rights legislation got passed. They don't remember the arm twisting.
Yeah, I think they're both true to some extent. And it's not clear to me how many Democrats are eager to run on health care. A good number of them are eager to change the subject. And as soon as this is passed, they're happy to talk about jobs, the economy, education reform, anything other than health care. Whereas you have a White House and some Democrats who are saying, no, this is something we need to go out there and own and talk about affirmatively and talk about the good things that it's done.
What's the feeling as to whether or not it will pass?
I think it's likely to pass on Sunday. I think the CBO numbers give another boost of momentum after the vote switch yesterday by Congressman Kucinich. I think they're close. I think they're probably within 10. They're in single digits now, going one by one. It's going to take a final push. But my sense in talking to people on the Hill is that Democratic leaders are optimistic that they're going to make this come together in the next 72 hours.
Rick Klein, senior political correspondent for ABC News, author of the network's blog, The Note. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Switching gears here to the song of a humpback whale. It's haunting. That sound was recorded by author Douglas Carlton Abrams as he researched his new novel, The Eye of the Whale, which tells the story of Elizabeth, a marine biologist whose decade-long study of the songs of humpback whales leads to a breakthrough discovery of how pollution is harming them and humans. The question becomes, if whales are the canary in the coal mine, can they warn a human, Elizabeth, as she swims with them?
The whale began to sing. The sounds penetrated Elizabeth's body, deeply piercing her ears and skin. She felt a pressure wave against her chest that made it difficult to breathe. Unlike the continuous tone of distress calls, this sound was shorter and more abrupt. It was the same sound the whale had made after her baby had died. But what did it mean?
The novel, The Eye of the Whale, is at times pretty florid. Elizabeth's marriage is failing. Evil doctors in bed with polluting industries are out to foil her research. But it's also fact-based. Pollution is affecting whales' reproduction, and there's proposed legislation in Congress that's focused on a little-known problem featured in the book, endocrine disruption, the undermining of development in children in utero. Endocrine disruption is a potentially dry topic, but author Douglas Carlton Abrams throws in romance, intrigue, and, of course, whales. And he joins us from Santa Cruz, California. Doug, welcome.
Great to be with you, Robin.
And we're also going to bring in a scientist in a moment to look at these real-life health effects. But first, why tell a story about environmental pollution through whales? What got you going?
Well, whales are fascinating. They're mythic creatures, an alien intelligence that we long to understand. And as I was researching, I discovered the connections between ocean health and human health, between whales and humans. And in fact, I discovered that sometimes the facts are more shocking than we novelists could ever make up.
Well, let's tick through some of the facts in the book, and we'll get to health. As we said, we have a scientist coming in. But you have your researcher studying social calls, whales' social calls. You write songs of the whales have long been studied, but social sounds were just being deciphered. It was like discovering an alien language. So what is true there, and what does your researcher think she might have discovered?
It was interesting. Actually, I worked with lots of marine scientists on what we can know and can't know about whale communication. And actually, as we were working on the novel, there were discoveries that were made. In particular, a mother-infant contact call was discovered that we were hypothesizing in the novel. It was the exact same sound. And actually, social sounds. Now, social sounds, Robin, are the kinds of things we say to each other every day. That's like saying, Robin, you want to go get a beer? Or a whale might say, hey, Robin, you want to go eat some krill? That's a social sound. And they actually found that social sounds are appearing in song. Now, what the meaning of those social sounds are in the song is still to be deciphered, and that's where we move into the fictional realm. But we are discovering that there is sophisticated communication in whales. We now know that they humpback whales have what are called spindle cell neurons that are very sophisticated neurons that allow us to have language and communication as humans. So we know that they have the hardware for it. Whether they're able to communicate at the level we are, that's still a mystery.
Well, and are they also able to have the emotional content to, for instance, as you propose, to actually try to warn humans of a polluting danger?
Well, I, you know, and actually in the novel, I left it open-ended in terms of where the whether the whales are trying to communicate with the humans or whether they're communicating with one another, and we just happen to overhear their communication.
Well, and meanwhile, you have been with the whales. You've swum with them, as your researcher does.
Yeah, I actually had the opportunity to go down to Tonga with a marine biologist, and I was able to record the whale behavior and the whale song down there with her, and it was the mother whale with the infant newborn whale resting on its back at the surface and an escort whale beneath. And when the escort whale saw us come into the water to record the behavior, he came over, eyeballed us, and actually raised his pectoral fin over my body to avoid knocking me out of his way. If he had chosen to do otherwise, I wouldn't be on the program with you today.
So you did see that, a mother whale with her newborn on her back. And you describe in the book, and we can maybe hear some more of the sounds that you recorded, but you also describe what it feels like to be in the water and hear the whale sounds. It's like a sonic wave.
Yes, that's correct. I actually heard the song through the headset as we were recording it from the surface. The closer you are, it's kind of like being right next to a bass speaker, and you get that incredible intensity, almost the physical feeling of the sound.
Well, but as we said at the outset, the whales are being affected by pollution. And we want to bring in now to our conversation Theo Colburn. She's best known for her studies on the health effects of endocrine disrupting chemicals. She co-authored Our Stolen Future in 1996, and her work has prompted new laws around the world. What are the problems that are surfacing in whales? What are the chemicals that cause these problems?
Well, in our lives, they come from practically everything that we use, from plastic toys to computers to cars, from the pesticides sprayed on our food to the cosmetics, hair products, and other toiletries we put on our bodies.
And what are the chemicals, if you can just name a few, these endocrine-disrupting chemicals? Is it just safe to say plastics, or what are they?
Oh, the list is, right now we're working on a list in our office. We're up to about 966 chemicals that you could call endocrine disruptors. But the most common ones that people know about are the PCBs, the flame retardants, the ones that are used in plastics, and so many that are used in cosmetics.
And what do they do? What's their negative impact?
Well, first, why don't I just tell you what we saw in fish, which led to our discovery of why we need to look at humans. In male fish across the country in rivers, streams, and lakes, they're producing eggs. Now, you know that's not normal. And the beluga whales were being born with both male and female sex organs. And we know this only because they died before reaching adulthood and were found dead on shorelines. And it was literature like this, female-female pairing of birds, abnormal behavior, lack of parenting among wild animals, led to this question of what is this doing to our children and our children's brains?
Well, we want to hear those answers. That's Theo Colburn. She co-authored the book Our Stolen Future and is professor emeritus at the University of Florida at Gainesville, also president of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. We'll link you to that. Douglas Carlton Abrams' new novel, The Eye of the Whale, incorporates a lot of Theo's science into his story. We're going to hear more from both after a quick break. Also, later today, quick reminder, regulating the credit agencies, how's that going? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our look at the impact of pollution on whales and people in real life and fiction. We've been speaking with Douglas Carlton Abrams, author of the novel Eye of the Whale. It's a story of a whale researcher who realizes that pollution is affecting the whales she's studying. And much of the novel is based on the work of Theo Colburn, a scientist who looks at how chemicals and toxins in the environment affect humans and other species. Theo, you start. List what you say is the impact of these chemicals on people.
ADHD, early onset and later life cancers like breast and prostate cancer later in life, early testicular cancer in young men, diabetes, infertility, Alzheimer's, and more recently, even obesity.
Are you seeing that in newborns in the way that Doug Abrams, in his book, again, his book is The Eye of the Whale, in the way he writes that it's being seen in newborn whales? Are we seeing that kind of odd sexual organs and that kind of outcome in infants?
Yeah, definitely.
That you can trace to endocrine disrupting chemicals?
Yes, ma'am. Certainly can. Look, testosterone levels have dropped by 17% over the past 20 years, and sperm counts have dropped by half in the last 60 years. And the sperm that men do have today are increasingly dysfunctional. Also, one in 125 boys are now being born with a birth defect called hypospadias, where the opening is not at the end of the penis. And this is just reproductive sex organ damage. But listen to this. In addition, one in three children born from now on will have diabetes before they die. But what is so scary about endocrine disruption is that it may take years before the chronic debilitating disorders start to appear. And unfortunately, the damage is irreversible. In terms of the impact on human health, endocrine disruption is an even more imminent threat than climate change, in the opinion of many who are doing this research. Believe me, really, the only way to tackle endocrine disruption is through prevention.
Well, and by that, do you mean banning products in production? What do you mean by prevention?
Getting the production of chemicals that can cause endocrine disruption out of production. The chemicals that also we need to get them out of the products that are going into our homes that we can use. What we need to do is go back and make sure there is enough science available so that the new products that are coming on the market or the alternatives or the replacements are safe.
Well, meanwhile, Doug Abrams, in your book, The Eye of the Whale, you remind us that how much whales are on the front lines of pollution because either we're throwing plastics away, and we know about the huge floating islands of plastic that won't biodegrade out in the ocean, or the waste from these production facilities is pouring into the water right where the whales are. You write about a beached beluga whale that dies in Canada and is treated like toxic waste because its body is so toxic. It had to be, you know, treated like a toxic waste dump before they could rid the body.
Yeah, actually, it is true. That scene was based on an actual autopsy of an actual beluga whale. And the beluga whales, in many cases, are so filled with these endocrine-disrupting chemicals and other toxins that they need a special permit to be transferred across provincial lines because they are treated like toxic waste.
Well, meanwhile, as we said, there's legislation in Congress focusing on endocrine disruption. What's the extent of it?
Well, fortunately, Representative Jim Moran and Senator John Kerry introduced a bill called the Endocrine Disruption Prevention Act, which allows for impartial scientists to inform the regulatory process using this vast knowledge we've gained over the past decade. It's exciting. This bill provides the first step to getting harmful chemicals out of mothers' bodies and those of their unborn children.
But what would you say to someone who says, you know, there's a certain law of nature, there's, you know, some things do die out. You know, there's a certain natural progression here.
This is not just about the extinction of one other species or even thousands of other species. This is about the potential viability of our own species. And I think that's why, as Theo mentioned earlier, so many scientists see that what's happening on the microcosm in endocrine disruption and environmental pollution as great a threat as climate change.
By the way, Theo, the main character in Doug's book is a researcher desperately trying to tell people something she's discovering. Are you familiar with that?
Well, this has been the story of my life. I discovered endocrine disruption in 1988. And it's been a tough story to tell. I mean, around the Great Lakes is where we began to see 16 top predator species that were becoming populations that were actually totally disappearing. No bald eagles were reproducing on the shoreline of the Great Lakes. And this was the first signal that toxicology, this science that was developed to protect us from chemicals in the environment, had missed this particular aspect of human development in determining whether chemicals were safe.
And by the way, anything hopeful you discovered while researching the novel?
One of the things that that I discovered in working with the scientists is that so much human disease and suffering is in fact human-made due to chemical pollution. If it's human-made, then obviously it's not inevitable. It can be ended. It can be reversed. And if we make different choices, then ourselves and our children and our grandchildren will have to suffer less and have less of the kind of chronic disease that Theo was outlining, the diabetes, childhood cancers. So many of the chronic diseases that we now accept as inevitable are in fact the result of choices that we're making in terms of what we're putting into our body and into our environment.
That's Douglas Carlton Abrams. Again, his book is The Eye of the Whale. It's a fictional account of what Theo Colburn says is a very real story. She's an environmental scientist specializing in endocrine disrupting chemicals. Thanks both so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
More than a million people are homeless, and there's still a shortage of shelter as the rainy season approaches Haiti. But there's another crisis as well. The January earthquake destroyed the country's jails, and the biggest prison escape in modern history put thousands of criminals back on the streets. The BBC's Mark Doyle toured Haiti's main national penitentiary in the capital Port-au-Prince and sent this report.
Behind what remain of the steel doors of Haiti's national penitentiary, there are many disturbing stories. I've come here to find out about the legacy of the mass jailbreak when the earthquake hit here on January the 12th. Over 5,000 prisoners escaped, most from this jail, some from smaller facilities where the walls also broke as the earth shook and the prison guards fled home to see if their families were alive. But one of the first things I saw on entering the prison wasn't evidence of the breakout, but evidence of the simply appalling conditions the inmates here suffered. I was in a place that was once a chapel of worship, but was now a vision of hell. It had been a communal cell about the size of a tennis court for 386 men. Filthy mattresses and rags lay knee-deep on the rat-infested floor, and from the ceilings and bars there hung hundreds of scrappy bags and plastic containers of water on the ends of long pieces of string. There were no toilets here, so I can only imagine that the bags were to keep the dank drinking water away from the sewage. 386 desperate prisoners were in here. No wonder they took their chance to escape. I was shown round by one of the prison directors, Charles Dehonet. Many of the prisoners were on remand when they fled. Haiti's system of justice is painfully slow. But others, the hard men, boasted strings of crimes. Rape, murder, assassination, he says, kidnapping, armed robbery, the list is long. And these people are now on the loose in a city smashed by an earthquake where the effectiveness of humanitarian aid has already been compromised by lack of coordination among aid workers and a weak Haitian government. In the prison compound, just round the corner from the chapel from hell, I heard a crowd of men. Through two cell windows, I saw two prisoners straining to position books under tiny shafts of light. One was praying from a Bible, the other from a Quran. They were among the 200 or so prisoners that the Haitian police have recaptured and put back in one of the cell blocks not too badly damaged by the earthquake. According to the prison boss, Charles Dehonet, the reopening of the prison was a vital symbol.
We had to reopen the prison to give the police somewhere to put the men to arrest. So reopening the prison has been vital to give ordinary people faith that the police and the courts are working again.
But 200 out of 5,000 escapees is few indeed. The Haitian police have their work cut out for them. But meanwhile, the government here has asked a number of foreign countries, including Britain, to help rebuild the jail and the justice system. Paul Biddle is a former prison officer in the UK, now working with the British Department for International Development, advising on how to rebuild Haiti's central jail.
Certainly, the major factors are building design, overcrowding, the impact on humanitarian aid. There's no doubt the criminality in Haiti will have taken a massive boost because of the escape.
The earthquake in Haiti had an immediate and catastrophic impact. It killed over 200,000 people and made well over a million homeless. The jailbreak has now added another trauma, a legacy of fear that will only go away when the criminals are recaptured. But the evidence of gross overcrowding I found at the jail tells another story. If there's to be justice and decency in the future, prison conditions will have to be improved too. Haiti has so much to rebuild, so much to fix.
The BBC's Mark Doyle in Haiti. And by the way, later today, Oscar-winning filmmaker Jonathan Demme on his long love affair with Haiti. This week, the credit rating agency Moody's warned the U.S. and other Western countries that they need to clamp down on spending or lose their top AAA credit rating. Wait a minute. Isn't Moody's one of the three agencies that gave those toxic financial instruments like mortgage-backed securities the A-OK and got us into this financial mess in the first place? Why are they still the arbiters? Congress said they were going to crack down on agencies. Where are we on that? Benjamin Applebaum is financial reporter for The Washington Post. Benjamin, welcome.
Thank you.
And we want to tell our listeners, we spoke about the history of rating agencies last summer. We'll link you to that at our website, but just briefly skipping through it. At one time, the major agencies were paid by the investors to rate investments. That changed. They're now paid by the companies that issue the debt. Eric Dash wrote last year that this is like Hollywood studios paying reviewers to review movies. So just tell us a little more about the relationship between rating agencies and companies and why it got us into trouble.
Yeah, that's not a bad analogy. You know, it's a system now where the companies that issue these bonds or investment products pay one of these rating agencies to assess the quality of it, basically to assess how likely the bond is to be completely repaid, how safe it is to invest in that bond. And they do that with a letter grade. Those letter grades run up to AAA. And investors really rely on them. Some investors have been told to rely on them by the government, which, for example, instructs banks only to purchase bonds and other investments with high ratings. But the net effect was that these agencies became the arbiters of what was a quality investment and what was not, and they weren't independent. Their judgments were not independent. They were being paid by the people who made those investments.
Well, a couple things. First of all, you mentioned the government, and you know, by the 70s, the government not only said instruments had to be rated, but it dubbed the three biggest agencies, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, nationally recognized statistical rating organizations. So it has to be these three agencies. And you mentioned the close relationships. Just remind us, was there ever any case of companies, you know, asking for rating increases and getting them?
Absolutely. And, you know, these range from, you know, the more scandalous instances, famously Countrywide, the major California mortgage lender, pushing its ratings agencies to upgrade the ratings on its bonds, but also just a more systemic and in some way more troubling level of practice. You know, ratings agencies started off rating corporations, basically. And if a corporation comes in for a rating, it is what it is, and they gave it what rating it deserved. But what they were rating in recent years were what were called structured investment products that could be changed and tweaked and adjusted to earn a rating. So in many cases, the ratings agencies and their clients were essentially collaborating to configure products in the way that would produce the best possible rating and then sending it out into the marketplace. Well, that was great for the person who was paying for the rating, but it wasn't necessarily great for the investor.
And things got a little more complicated when the companies, for instance, Moody's, went public, meaning they now had stockholders pressuring them to make more money. The more complicated the financial instrument, the more they got paid by the company. So,
absolutely, and the pursuit of market share drove a lot of this.
Right. So it would seem like a no-brainer that some of this would be teased out. Let's start with the Senate. What is Chris Dodd proposing to regulate credit rating agencies?
So there's sort of three legs to this stool. One is that they are going to regulate credit agencies for the first time. At least that's the proposal. The Securities and Exchange Commission would create a new office that would oversee these companies, that would assess the quality of their ratings, that could, in theory, pull their right to issue ratings if they didn't do a good job over time. The second leg is increased disclosure and transparency. This is an effort basically to limit the chances that a company will provide a good rating just because it wants to attract business. It requires them to publish their methodology, to publish when a company comes in and says, hey, what rating would you give me if I decided to work with you? If they give them a quote, that quote needs to be made public so that they can't, change it later. A number of provisions like this that center on transparency. And then the third leg of the stool is liability. It would basically say if a company makes mistakes, does it through gross negligence or even malice, they can be sued. They can be held liable for these opinions that they've published. An investor who relied on it could go to the courts and say, I trusted Moody's. They led me astray. I want my money back.
Well, that's the Senate. Is the House proposal pretty much along the same lines?
It's very similar. I mean, there's a lot of technical differences, but these three legs of the stool are the same. It's an approach based on transparency, regulation, and liability.
Is anyone, though, suggesting changing the relationship between the rating agencies and the companies? Going back to the day we heard a quote from 1957 when an official at Moody's said, there's no way we could be paid by the same companies that issue this debt. That would be a conflict of interest, which is exactly what we have now. Is there any suggestion of going back to the investors being the ones that pay the rating agencies, not the companies that issue the debt?
There are smaller ratings agencies that still provide ratings that investors pay for. So that business model has not gone extinct. But there are also very good reasons why the big rating agencies don't work that way. One key reason is that it makes the ratings more broadly available. Rather than limiting it to people who pay for it, the company that is issuing the bond pays for the rating and the rating becomes publicly available. So you're not hearing a lot of proposals to change the basic nature of the system. But what some people would like to see, a more radical approach to reform, is to stop the reliance, the regulatory reliance on ratings, to change the various rules and provisions that make banks dependent on these ratings, that require them to invest in products with good ratings. You know, we've basically outsourced risk management under this system. Rather than asking banks to determine if an investment is safe, banks can rely on the judgment of the ratings agency, and there are some pretty prominent experts on this issue who think that that's a bad approach and that we ought to return to an approach where the bank needs to justify the quality of the investment.
Well, but some would say, why hasn't more been done to tamp down the role of ratings agencies when it's so obvious the role they played in the financial collapse?
There's two big reasons. The first is that it's really hard to change the way something works. Ratings agencies have become embedded in the fabric of our financial system. But there's another reason, too, that gets ignored sometimes, which is that investors really like ratings. They help people make quick judgments, and it is a big reason that there's a reluctance to make dramatic changes, even now, even after so many people have been burned.
Well, Gretchen Morgenson of The Times mentions another potential reason, which is that these are big companies now, and they have a lot of lobbying money, and it has increased quite a bit over the past year.
And we've heard them loudly down here in Washington in recent months making the case for their continued role at the heart of the financial system.
Benjamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The Washington Post on efforts to regulate credit rating agencies. Benjamin, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And one last note on this. We mentioned that right now the House and Senate proposed bills don't address the issue of how credit rating agencies are paid. Both bills, though, do propose setting up studies on compensation and on how agencies work and how to make them relevant. But it could take a while. Those studies are expected to take up to 2.5 years to complete. We're going to take a minute break. When we come back, a free-range chat with Director Jonathan Demme. You're listening to Here and Now. March has been a banner month for filmmaker Jonathan Demme. His latest concert documentary, Neil Young Trunk Show, opens tomorrow. It's a new look at a musician Demme first filmed in 2006. Here's some of the new version.
Did she wake you up to tell you that it was only a change of plan?
Also, earlier this month, Jonathan Demme was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Coolidge Corner Theater here in Boston. He's nowhere near finished, but the list is already impressive. It includes 2008's Rachel Getting Married, of course 1991's Silence of the Lambs, one of the few films to pick up all five major Academy Awards, including Best Director for Demi. Then there was Philadelphia, which addressed AIDS, and The Agronomist, Demi's portrait of the Haitian activist Jean Dominique, who turned Radio Haiti into a bullhorn for reform.
The owner said, "Are you interested buying the station?" That was it. I had my chance. I took the chance. It was under the dictatorship of François Duvalier, the father. It was a very, very risky business.
The Agronomist is not Demi's first documentary about Haiti, and it won't be his last. He'd already planned to make a new one before the earthquake hit. It's still in the works. The Coolidge Theater held a screening of The Agronomist to benefit Haiti, and we sat down with Jonathan Demi to talk about his passion for that country.
Somewhere in the mid-80s, I fell madly in love with Haitian art, and I quickly went to Haiti and met the country, met the people. And my love moved from Haitian art to the Haitian people, and I was so admiring of the spirit, this incredible energy that was going towards the idea. There's this idealized, beautiful vision of what democracy could mean in the lives of future generations in Haiti. And I've always felt that we keep saying, well, what more can be thrown at the Haitian people? They've had dictatorships, they've had coups, they've had hurricanes and floods, and now an earthquake. But, you know, I've always felt that all these things that hit Haiti, the ecological crisis, the corruption, the massive corruption, the oppression of military, this is stuff that the whole human race is contending with all over the world at all times. Haiti meets the worst challenges first, but we're all headed towards them.
Well, now, how does your documentary work? And this obvious passion that you have and compassion that you have, what happens when you switch to feature? Are you still an activist? Are you still being a progressive when you're making a feature fiction film?
Well, I'm not really an activist at all.
You don't think so?
No. I'm an enthusiast. I make films about things I'm enthusiastic about. It might be an enthusiasm for a documentary about a great man, Jean Dominique, and a great country, Haiti. Or if it's a Neil Young or a Robin Hitchcock film, I'm tremendously enthusiastic about their music. If it's a fiction film, it's because I fall in love with a screenplay like Rachel Getting Married or Silence of the Lambs or Married to the Mob. But I don't like to think of myself as an activist, as a witness bearer. I think as a filmmaker, you know, I bear witness to things, and I make these images available for people to, by extension, bear witness to. But that's kind of it.
Do I understand? Do I read you're 66 years old?
Yes.
Young, in my mind. And yet, I'm wondering, are you at a point in your career where you're also thinking, it takes a long time to make a film? I mean, you know, there's a limited, maybe you're nodding yes, a limited number of films. Like, what films do you want to make given that?
It's true. You can't help doing the math at a certain point. And if here I am in my mid-60s, how many more years can I make films? How many more films will I make? My enthusiasm meter is out of control at the moment. I want to make so many more films specifically than I will ever get to make. But, all these films cost money. That will determine what films I make.
Is there a fiction movie that you've said to yourself that you want to make, or are you just waiting for a script to come?
There is, can't mention any titles exactly, but there's a Stephen King book that I'm madly in love with and want very much to make a film out of. There's a film that's kind of a thriller, a book that's a thriller. I'm very, very, you know, I've come to believe more and more in literature, by the way, as a source material for terrific films. If you can find a book that's rich and truthful and has all the character depth that we expect from a book and what have you, I think you can really, for me, it becomes easier to see the great movie that's lurking inside of it.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Is one of your challenges finding somebody to top Hannibal Lecter?
No. I don't think of any of this stuff as in terms of it being any kind of contest. I feel like the challenge is to make a terrific movie, but I think that I will confess the fact that if I'm going to do a suspense film, I guess I probably, I'm now going to refute myself, I guess I probably have to feel that this film would have the potential for being as strong as Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. When you made Silence of the Lambs, I think I'm right in this. I don't think you were a father. Is that, yeah. So does that change the way you look at making a film, the fact that you have, I've read, a daughter at least?
I have three children. And for me, Silence of the Lambs is about somebody trying to save a child. I think the power of that story, of that book, that great book by Thomas Harris, the power they have isn't because of the unusually rich, amazing, original, quote-unquote, villains or what have you. I think for me the real power is Jodie Foster's Clarice Starling, this young woman who's determined to save somebody else's daughter from being killed.
Catherine Martin!
Yes!
FBI! You're safe!
Is there something that you haven't been asked about your filmmaking? Is there some comment that you haven't heard that you're hoping someone will notice and note about your body of work?
There's something I'd like to point out. If anybody thinks that any of these pictures are good films, I've got a label that explains it. I think that all of the films I've done, for better or for worse, are acts of collective invention. A big group of us gather together. Everybody's expert in one field or another, and maybe they're on the actor side of the camera, or maybe they're on the kind of technical artistic side of it. But everybody shows up and does their work, and it all comes together in this act of collective invention. With the last fiction I did, Rachel Getting Married, I barely directed that at all. And Jenny Lamette had written, I think, a great screenplay. We assembled a terrific cast, and Declan Quinn, the director of photography, we agreed that we would shoot this film the way we shoot our documentaries, i.e. nothing pre-staged. I would just kind of say, okay, go, and the actors would start acting. Declan would find a shot, and this is how we did the entire movie.
But you've never said anything to me that's remotely apologetic, yet all of a sudden at my wedding dinner in front of everybody, you decide to grace us all with your development.
I just got home.
I'm there in my director's chair, kind of somehow or other, I don't know quite, I don't even know what I'm doing, except being grateful that I have the people that have showed up. I aspire to working with incredibly gifted people in all areas, and I think that to whatever extent my pictures have done well, it's because the collective invention factor has really flourished.